to think about what had happened in the war. As I grew comfortable with Esther, I talked to her mainly about Bob Marley's lyrics and Run DMC's too. She mostly listened. Twice a week, Leslie came and went over the lyrics with me. He loved telling me the history of Rastafarianism. I loved the history of Ethiopia and the story of the meeting of the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. I related to the long distance they traveled and their determination to reach their chosen destination. I wish that my journey had been as meaningful and as full of merriment as theirs. It happened one night after I had fallen asleep while reading the lyrics of a song. I had not slept well for months now, and so far I had been able to avoid my nightmares by busying myself day and night with listening to and writing the lyrics of Bob Marley's songs. But that night, I had a nightmare that was different from the ones I had been having. It began with my swimming in a river at Matrujong with my brother, Junior. We dove to the bottom of the river and brought out oysters. We placed them on a rock and plunged to the deep again. We were competing with each other. In the end, Junior got more oysters than I did. We ran home for dinner, racing each other. When we got there, the food was sitting in pots, but no one was around. I turned to ask my brother what was happening, but he was gone. I was alone, and it was dark. I searched for a lamp and found it, but I was afraid. My forehead was sweating. I took the lamp to the living room, where a box of matches sat on the table. I lit the lamp, and as soon as the room was bright, I saw men standing all around. They had circled me in the dark. I could see their bodies, except for their faces, which were darker, as if they were headless walking beings. Some were barefoot and others wore army boots. All had guns and knives. They began to shoot, stab, and slice each other's throats, but they would rise and then get killed again. Their blood began to fill the room, its tide quickly rising. They wailed, causing me great anguish. I held my ears to stop hearing them, but I began to feel their pain. Each time a person was stabbed, I felt it worse. I saw the blood dripping from the same part of my body as that of the victim. I began to cry as the blood filled the room. The men disappeared and the door immediately opened, letting the blood out with a rush. I went outside with the blood all over me and saw my mother, father, older and younger brother. They were all smiling as if nothing had happened, as if we had been together all this time. "Sit down, Mr. Troublesome," my father said. "Don't mind him," my mother chuckled. I sat down facing my father, but couldn't eat with them. My body had gotten numb, and my family didn't seem to notice that I was covered with blood. It began to rain, and my family ran into the house, leaving me outside. I sat in the rain for a while, letting it clean the blood off me. I got up to go into the house, but it wasn't there. It had disappeared. I was looking around confused when I woke up from the dream. I had fallen off my bed. I got up and went outside and sat on the stoop, looking into the night. I was still confused as I couldn't tell whether I'd had a dream or not. It was the first time I had dreamt of my family since I started running away from the war. The next afternoon, I went to see Esther and she could tell that something was bothering me. "Do you want to lie down?" she asked, almost whispering. "I had this dream last night. I don't know what to make of it," I said, looking away. She came and sat next to me and asked, "Would you like to tell me about it?" I didn't reply. "Or just talk about it out loud and pretend I am not here. I won't say anything, only if you ask me." She sat quietly beside me. The quietness lasted for a while, and for some reason I began to tell her my dream. At first she just listened to me, and then gradually she started asking questions to make me talk about the lives I had lived before and during the war. "None of these things are your fault," she would always say sternly at the end of every conversation. Even though I had heard that phrase from every staff member, and frankly, I had always hated it, I began that day to believe it. It was the genuine tone in Esther's voice that made the phrase finally begin to sink into my mind and heart. That didn't make me immune from the guilt that I felt for what I had done. Nonetheless, it lightened my bothersome memories and gave me strength to think about things. The more I spoke about my experiences to Esther, the more I began to cringe at the gruesome details, even though I didn't let her know that. I didn't completely trust Esther. I only liked talking to her because I felt that she didn't judge me for what I had been a part of. She looked at me with the same inviting eyes and welcoming smile that said I was a child. One evening, Esther took me to her house and made me dinner. After dinner, we went for a walk in the city. We went to the wharf at the end of Rawdon Street. The moon was out that night, and we sat at the jetty and watched it. I told Esther about the shapes I used to see in the moon when I was much younger. She was fascinated. We looked at the moon and described the shapes we saw to each other. I saw the woman cradling the baby in her arms, just as I used to. On our way back to her house, I didn't look at the city lights any longer. I looked into the sky and felt as if the moon was following us. When I was a child, my grandmother told me that the sky speaks to those who look and listen to it. She said, "In the sky, there are always answers and explanations for everything, every pain, every suffering, joy, and confusion." That night, I wanted the sky to talk to me. Chapter 18. One day, during my 5th month at Benin Home, I was sitting on a rock behind the classrooms when Esther came by. She sat next to me without uttering a word. She had my lyrics notebook in her hand. "I feel as if there is nothing left for me to be alive for," I said slowly. "I have no family. It is just me. No one will be able to tell stories about my childhood." I sniffled a bit. Esther put her arms around me and pulled me closer to her. She shook me to get my full attention before she started. "Think of me as your family, your sister." "But I didn't have a sister," I replied. "Well, now you do. You see, this is the beauty of starting a new family. You can have different kinds of family members." She looked at me directly, waiting for me to say something. "Okay, you can be my sister. Temporarily," I emphasized the last word. "That is fine with me. So will you come to see your temporary sister tomorrow, please?" She covered her face as if she would be sad if I said no. Okay, no need to be sad," I said, and we both laughed a bit. Esther's laugh always reminded me of Abigail, a girl I had seen during my first 2 semesters of secondary school in Bowtown. Sometimes I wish Esther was Abigail so that we could talk about past times before the war. I wanted us to laugh with all our beings, longer and without any worries, as I had done with Abigail, but couldn't anymore. At the end of each laugh, there was always some feeling of sadness that I couldn't escape. At times, I stared at Esther while she was busy doing paperwork. Whenever she sensed my eyes examining her face, she would throw a folded paper at me without looking in my direction. I would smile and put the folded paper in my pocket, pretending that the blank paper was a special note she had written to me. That afternoon, as Esther walked away from where I sat on the rock, she continually turned around to wave at me, until she disappeared behind one of the halls. I smiled back and forgot about my loneliness for the time being. The following day, Esther told me that there were visitors coming to the center. The staff had asked the boys to hold a talent show. Basically, we were all supposed to do anything that we were good at. "You can sing your reggae songs," Esther suggested. "How about a Shakespeare monologue?" I asked. "Okay, but I still think you should do some music." She put her arms around me. I had become very fond of Esther but refused to show it. Whenever she hugged me or put her arms around me, I would quickly break loose. Whenever she left, though, I watched her go. She had a unique and graceful walk. It was almost as if she sailed on the ground. I would always run to see her after class to tell her about my day. My friends Mambu and Alaji made fun of me. "Your girlfriend is here, Ishmael. Are we going to see you at all this afternoon?" The visitors from the European Commission, the UN, UNICEF, and several NGOs arrived at the center in a convoy of cars one afternoon. They wore suits and ties and shook hands with each other before they started walking around the center. Some of the boys followed behind them, and I sat on the veranda with Mambu. All of the visitors were smiling, sometimes adjusting their ties or taking notes on the riding pads they carried. Some of them looked into our sleeping places, and the others took off their jackets and played hand-wrestling games and a tug-of-war with boys. Afterward, they were shepherded into the dining room, which had been set up quite nicely for the talent show. Mr. Kamara, the director of the center gave a few remarks, and then boys started telling Brass Spider and Monster stories and performing tribal dances. I read a monologue from Julius Caesar and performed a short hip-hop play about the redemption of a former child soldier that I had written with Esther's encouragement. After that event, I became popular at the center. Mr. Kamara called me to his office one morning and said, "You and your friends really impressed those visitors. They know now that it is possible for you boys to be rehabilitated. I was just happy to have had the chance to perform again in peace." But Mr. Kamara was in high spirits. "How would you like to be the spokesperson for this center?" he asked me. "Ah, what will I have to do or say?" I hesitantly asked. I was beginning to think that this whole thing was being blown out of proportion. "Well, to begin with, if there's an event on the issue of child soldiers, we will write you something to read. Once you get comfortable, you can begin writing your own speech or whatever you want." Mr. Kamara's serious face told me he meant what he was saying. Not more than a week later, I was talking at gatherings in Freetown about child soldiering and how it must be stopped. "We can be rehabilitated," I would emphasize, and point to myself as an example. I would always tell people that I believe children have the resilience to outlive their suffering if given a chance. I was at the end of my 6 months when my childhood friend Mohammed arrived at the center. The last time I had seen him was when I left Mogbimo with Taloy and Junior for a performance in Matrujong. He couldn't come with us that day as he was helping his father work on their kitchen, but I never thought I would see him again. I was returning from a gathering at St. Edward's Secondary School that evening when I saw this light-skinned, skinny boy with bony cheeks sitting on the stoop by himself. He looked familiar, but I wasn't sure if I knew him. As I approached, he jumped up. "Hey man, remember me?" he exclaimed, and began doing the running man and singing, "Here comes the hammer." I joined him, and we did some of the moves we had learned together for a group dance to this particular song. We high-fived each other, and then hugged. He was still taller than me. We sat together on the stoop and briefly talked about our childhood pranks. Sometimes, I think about those great times we had dancing at talent shows, practicing new dances, playing soccer until we couldn't see the ball. It seems like all those things happened a very long time ago. "It is really strange, you know," he said, looking away for a bit. I know," I said. "You were a troublesome boy," he reminded me. "I know, I know." It was at the beginning of my 7th month at the rehabilitation center when Leslie came again to have a chat. I was called to a room in the hospital where he waited. When I walked into the room, he stood up to greet me. His face showed both grief and happiness. I had to ask him what the matter was. "Are you all right?" I started him. "Yes." He scratched his head and mumbled something to himself. "I am sorry about bringing up this matter again. I know it will upset you, but I have to be honest with you," Leslie said. He walked around the room and began. "We cannot locate any immediate family member of yours, so we have to find you a foster family here in the city. I hope that will be fine with you. I will check on you after you've completed your rehabilitation to see how you are doing in your new life." He sat down and, looking at me, continued. "Well, do you have any concerns or questions?" "Yes, I think so," I said. I told him that before the war, my father had spoken about my uncle who lived in the city. I did not even know what he looked like, much less where he lived. "What is his name?" Leslie asked. "His name is Tommy, and my father told me he is a carpenter," I replied. Leslie was writing my mysterious uncle's name in his notebook. After he was done scribbling his notes, he said, "No promises, but I will see what I can find out. I will get back to you soon." He paused, tapped me on the shoulder, and continued, "I hear you are doing great. Keep it up." He walked out of the room. I didn't count on him being able to find my uncle in such a big city, especially with the little information I had provided. I left the room and went to see Esther at the other side of the building. She was busy putting away the new supplies of bandages and medicines in the cabinets that hung on the walls of the room. As soon as she noticed that I was standing in the doorway, she began to smile, but continued doing her work. I sat and waited for her to finish. "So how did the meeting with Leslie go?" she asked as she put the last box of medicine away. I told her everything he had said, ending with my skepticism about whether Leslie would be able to find my uncle. She listened carefully and said, "You never know, he might find him." One Saturday afternoon, as I chatted with Esther and Mohammed, Leslie walked in, smiling widely. I suspected he had found me a foster home and that I was going to be repatriated, the term used to describe the process of reuniting ex-child soldiers with their former communities. "What is the good news?" Esther asked. Leslie examined my curious face, then walked back to the door and opened it. A tall man walked in. He had a wide, genuine smile that made his face look like a little boy's. His hands were long and he looked at me directly, smiling. He wasn't as light-skinned as my father. "This is your uncle," Leslie proudly announced. "Howdy, buddy Ishmael," the man said, and walked over to where I was sitting. He bent over and embraced me long and hard. My arms hung loose at my sides. "What if he's just some man pretending to be my uncle?" I thought. The man let go of me. He was crying, which is when I began to believe that he was really my family, because his crying was genuine and men in my culture rarely cried. He crouched on his heels next to me and began, "I am sorry I never came to see you all those years. I wish I had met you before today, but we can't go back now. We just have to start from here. I am sorry for your losses. Leslie told me everything." He looked at Leslie with thankful eyes and continued, "After you are done here, you can come and live with me. You are my son. I don't have much, but I will give you a place to sleep, food, and my love." He put his arms around me. No one had called me son in a very long time. I didn't know what to say. Everyone, it seemed, was waiting for my response. I turned to my uncle, smiled at him, and said, "Thank you for coming to see me. I really appreciate that you have offered me to stay with you, but I don't even know you." I put my head down. "Like I said, we cannot go back, but we can start from here. I am your family and that is enough for us to begin liking each other," he replied, rubbing my head and laughing a little. I got up and hugged my uncle and he embraced me harder than he had the first time and kissed me on my forehead. We briefly stood in silence before he began to speak again. "I can't stay long because I have to finish some work at the other part of the city, but from now on, I will visit you every weekend, and if it is okay, I would like you to come home with me at some point to see where I live and to meet my wife and children, your family." My uncle's voice trembled. He was trying to hold back sobs. He rubbed my head with one hand and shook Leslie's hand with the other. "Sir, from now on you will be informed about how this young man is doing," Leslie said. "Thank you," my uncle replied. He held my hand, and I walked with him toward the van that he and Leslie had arrived in. Before my uncle got into the car with Leslie, he hugged me again and said, "You look like your father, and you remind me of him when we were growing up. I hope you are not as stubborn as he was." He laughed, and I did too. Esther, Mohammed, and I waved them off. "He seems like a nice man," Esther said as soon as the van disappeared from our sight. "Congratulations, man. You have a family member in the city, away from all the madness," Mohammed said. "I guess so," I said, but I didn't know what to do in my happy state. I was still hesitant to let myself let go, because I still believe in the fragility of happiness. "Come on, man, cheer up," Mohammed pulled my ears, and he and Esther lifted me up and carried me back to the hospital, laughing. At the hospital, Esther put the Bob Marley cassette on the tape player, and we all began to mime Three Little Birds together. "Don't worry about a thing," we sang, "'cause every little thing gonna be all right." That night, I sat on the veranda with Mambu, Alhaji, and Mohammed. We were quiet as usual. The sound of an ambulance somewhere in the city took over the silence of the night. I began to wonder about what my uncle was doing at that moment. I imagined him gathering his family to tell them about me. I could see him sobbing during his account, and his family gradually joining him in crying. Part of me wanted them to cry as much as they could before I met them, as I always felt uncomfortable when people cried because of what I had been through. I looked at Alhaji and Mambu, who were staring into the dark night. I wanted to tell them about the discovery of my uncle, But I felt guilty, since no one from their families had been found. I also didn't want to destroy the silence that had returned after the ambulance wailing died down. As my uncle promised, he came to visit every weekend. "My uncle is coming. I saw him down the road by the mango tree," I told Esther the first weekend after his initial visit. "You sound excited." She put her pen down. She examined my face for a while and then continued. "I told you he seemed like a good man." My uncle walked through the door and wiped his sweaty forehead with his handkerchief before hugging me. He said hello to Esther during our embrace. As soon as we stood apart, he began to smile so widely that my face relaxed and I too began to smile. He put his bag on the floor and pulled out some biscuits and a bottle of cold ginger beer. "I thought you might need some fuel for our walk," he said as he handed me the presents. "You two should take the gravel road up the hill," Esther suggested. My uncle and I nodded in agreement. "I won't be here when you return." "It is nice meeting you again, sir," she said, looking at my uncle. She turned toward me. "I will see you tomorrow." My uncle and I left the hospital room and started walking in the direction Esther had suggested. We were quiet at first. I listened to the sound of our footsteps on the dusty road. I could hear the rattling of lizards crossing the road to climb the nearby mango tree. I could feel my uncle's eyes on me. "How is everything? Are they treating you well at this place?" my uncle asked. "Everything is fine here," I replied. "I hope you are not as quiet as your father." He wiped his forehead again and then asked, "Did your father ever talk about his home?" "Sometimes he did, although not as much as I wished he had." I raised my lowered head and briefly met my uncle's kind, inviting eyes before looking away. The gravel road was getting narrower as we approached the bottom of the hill. I told him that my father had mentioned him in every one of his stories of a troublesome childhood. Told him that my father had recounted to me about the time they went to the bush to fetch firewood and accidentally shook a beehive. The bees chased them and they ran toward the village. Since my father was shorter, most of the bees concentrated on my uncle's head. They ran and dove into a river, but the bees circled on top of the water, waiting for them to resurface. They had to catch their breath, so they got out of the water and ran to their village, bringing the bees with them. "Yes, I remember. Everyone was upset with us for bringing the bees to the village, because they stung the old man who couldn't run fast, and some younger children. Your father and I locked the door, hid under the bed, and laughed at the commotion." My uncle was giggling, and I couldn't help but laugh. After he stopped laughing, he sighed and said, "Ah, your father and I, we did too many troublesome things. If you are as troublesome as we were, I will give you some leeway, because it wouldn't be fair for me to get down on you." He put his arm around my shoulder. "I think my troublesome days are long gone," I said sadly. "Ah, you are still a boy. You have time to be a little more troublesome," my uncle said. We became quiet again and listened to the evening wind whizzing through the trees. I loved the walks with my uncle because they gave me a chance to talk about my childhood, about growing up with my father and older brother. I needed to talk about those good times before the war, but the more I talked about my father, the more I missed my mother and little brother too. I didn't grow up with them. I felt as if I missed that chance and would never get it again, and that made me sad. I spoke to my uncle about it, but he just listened because he knew neither my mother nor my little brother. So in order to balance things out for me, he made me talk about the time my family lived in Matrujong when my parents were together. Even then, there wasn't that much to say as my parents separated when I was very young. I got to know my uncle quite well during our walks, and I began to eagerly await his arrival on weekends. He always brought me a present and would tell me about his week. He talked about the roof he had built for someone's house, the beautiful table he had to complete the next day by polishing it, how well my cousins were doing in school. He said hello from his wife. I in turn would tell him about the table tennis and soccer tournaments I had participated in, the performance we had given for visitors, if there was any that week. We walked so many times on the same gravel road that I could close my eyes and still avoid all the big rocks on the road. One weekend, my uncle took me to meet his family. It was a Saturday, and the sun was so bright that we couldn't see our shadows on the ground. He lived in New Englandville, a hilly area in the western part of Freetown. My uncle came to Benin home earlier than usual to get me. We took a noisy lorry to the center of the city. My uncle and I were quiet for a while, but began to laugh because the two men sitting next to us were discussing which palm wine was better, one that was from a standing palm tree or one from a fallen tree. The men were still arguing when we got off the lorry. We walked slowly toward my uncle's house, his arm around my shoulders. I was happy walking with my uncle, but I was worried whether his family would accept me the way he had, without asking me anything about my war years. As we walked up the hill, nearing my uncle's home, he pulled me aside and said, "I told only my wife about your past life as a soldier. I kept it secret from my children. I don't think they will understand now, as my wife and I do. I hope it is okay with you." Relieved, I nodded, and we continued on. Immediately after a bend and a rise on the gravel road, we came upon my uncle's house. It overlooked the city, and from the veranda one could see the ships in the bay. It was a beautiful view of the city, this place that was to become my home. The house had no electricity or running water, and the kitchen that stood apart from the house was made entirely of zinc. Under the mango tree, a few meters from the yard, was the latrine, and the coolie, open-air shower. It reminded me of Matrujong. When we walked onto the veranda, my uncle's wife came out, her face glowing as if she had polished it all her life. She stood at the doorway and tied her wrapper before proceeding to embrace me so tightly that I felt my nose and lips being squashed against her arms. She released me, stood back, and pinched my cheeks. "Welcome, my son," she said. She was a short woman with very dark skin, round cheekbones, and bright eyes. My uncle didn't have children of his own, so he raised the children of family members as his own. There were four of them: Ali, the oldest one, Matilda, Kona, and Sombo, the littlest, who was 6 years old. They had all stopped doing their chores and came onto the veranda to hug their brother, as my uncle explained my relation to them. "It is good to have another boy in the family," Ali said after he hugged me. He and my uncle laughed and I smiled. I was very quiet that afternoon. After the introduction, everyone went about his or her business. I was left with my aunt and uncle, and we sat on the veranda. I loved the view from the house and kept looking toward the city. Each time I turned to look at my uncle, he was smiling widely. My aunt continually brought us huge plates of rice, fish, stew, and plantains. She made me eat so much that my stomach became too big. After we had finished eating, my uncle showed me his carpentry tools and his work table, which was outside, occupying most of the little yard. "If you are interested in carpentry, I would be glad to have you as my apprentice. But knowing your father, I could probably guess that you want to go to school," my uncle said. I smiled and didn't say a word. Ali came back and asked Uncle if it was okay for me to go with him to a local soccer match. My uncle said only if I wanted to. I went with Ali down the street to a field in an area called Brookfields. "I am happy that you will be staying with us. We can share my room," Ali said as we waited for the game to begin. He was older than I was and had finished secondary school. He was jovial and very disciplined. It showed in his manners. He spoke well and to the point. Before the game started, a girl waved to us from the other side of the field. She had the most beautiful and open smile, and she was laughing a lot. I was about to ask who she was when Ali spoke. "She's our cousin, but she lives across the street with a foster family. Her name is Aminata. You will get to meet her." Aminata was the daughter of my father's second brother, who had a different mother. I later became closer to her and Ali than to the other children in my new family. During my many walks with my uncle, I learned that my grandfather had many wives and that my father had brothers he never talked about. My father was the only child from his mother's side. At the soccer match, All I could think about was the discovery of a family I never thought existed. I was happy, but I had become accustomed to not showing it. Ali laughed throughout the game, and I couldn't even get myself to smile. When we returned, my uncle was on the veranda, waiting to take me back to the center. He held my hand as we walked to the bus station. I was quiet the entire trip. I spoke only to thank my uncle after he had given me transportation money to use if I decided to visit on my own. At the entrance of the center, my uncle hugged me, and as we parted, he turned around and said, "I will see you soon again, my son." Chapter 19. 2 weeks earlier, Leslie had told me that I was going to be repatriated and reinstated into normal society. I was to live with my uncle. Those 2 weeks felt longer than the 8 months I had spent at Benin home. I was worried about living with the family. I had been on my own for years and had taken care of myself without any guidance from anyone. I was afraid that I might look ungrateful to my uncle, who didn't have to take me in, if I distanced myself from the family unit. I was worried about what to do when my nightmares and migraines took hold of me. How was I going to explain my sadness, which I am unable to hide as it takes over my face, to my new family, especially the children? I didn't have answers to these questions, and when I told Esther about them, she told me that everything was going to be fine, but I wanted more than just a reassurance. I lay in my bed night after night, staring at the ceiling and thinking, why have I survived the war? Why was I the last person in my immediate family to be alive? I didn't know. I stopped playing soccer and table tennis. I went to see Esther every day, though, and would say hello, ask how she was, and then get lost in my own head, thinking about what life was going to be like after the center. Sometimes Esther would have to snap her fingers in front of my face to bring me back. At night, I quietly sat on the veranda with Muhammad, Alhaji, and Mambu. I wouldn't notice when they left the bench that we all sat on. When the day of my repatriation finally came, I packed my few belongings in a plastic bag. I had a pair of sneakers, 4 t-shirts, 3 shorts, toothpaste, a toothbrush, a bottle of Vaseline lotion, a Walkman and some cassettes, 2 long-sleeve shirts, and 2 pairs of pants and a tie. These had been bought for me to wear for my conference talks. I waited, my heart beating faster the way it had when my mother dropped me off for the first time at a boarding school. The van was heard galloping on the gravel road, making its way to the center. Picking up my plastic bag, I walked to the hospital building where I was to wait. Muhammad, Alhaji, and Mambu were sitting on the front steps, and Esther emerged, smiling. The van made a turn and halted at the side of the road. It was late afternoon. The sky was still blue, but the sun was dull, hiding behind the only cloud. Leslie sat in the front seat and waited for me to board so he could take me to my new home. "I have to go," I said to everyone, my voice shaking. I extended my hand to Muhammad, but instead of shaking it, he leapt up and hugged me. Mambo embraced me while Muhammad was still holding me. He squeezed me hard, as if he knew it was goodbye forever. After I left the center, Mambo went back to the front lines because his family refused to take him in. At the end of the hug, Alhaji shook hands with me. We squeezed each other's hand and stared in each other's eyes, remembering all that we had been through. I tapped him on the shoulder, and he smiled as he understood that I was saying that we were going to be fine. I never saw him again, since he continually moved from one foster home to another. At the end of our handshake, Alhaji stepped back, saluted me, and whispered, "Goodbye, squad leader." I tapped him on the shoulder again. I couldn't salute him in return. Esther stepped forward, her eyes watery. She hugged me tighter than she ever had. I didn't return her hug very well, as I was busy trying to hold back my tears. After she let go, she gave me a piece of paper. "This is my address. Come by any time," she said. I went to Esther's home several weeks after that. My timing wasn't good, as she was on her way to work. She hugged me, and this time I squeezed back. This made her laugh after we stood apart. She looked me straight in the eyes. "Come and see me next weekend so we can have more time to catch up, okay?" she said. She was wearing her white uniform and was on her way to take on all the traumatized children. It must be tough living with so many war stories. I was just living with one, mine, and it was difficult, as the nightmares about what had happened continued to torment me. Why does she do it? Why do they all do it? I thought as we went our separate ways. It was the last time I saw her. I loved her but never told her. My uncle picked me up in his arms as soon as I got off the van and carried me onto the veranda. I welcome you today like a chief. Your feet may touch the ground when you lose your chieftaincy, which begins now, my uncle said, laughing as he set me down. I smiled, but was nervous. My four cousins, Ali and the three girls, Matilda, Kona, and Sumbo, took turns hugging me, their faces bright with smiles. You must be hungry. I cooked you a welcome home saki tomboy, my aunt said. She had made cassava leaves with chicken just to welcome me. To have chicken prepared for anyone was a rarity, and it was considered an honor. People ate chicken only on holidays like Christmas or New Year's. Auntie Sally held my hand and made me sit on a bench next to my uncle. She brought the food out, and my uncle and I ate together from the same plate with our hands. It was a good meal, and I licked my fingers, enjoying the rich palm oil. My uncle looked at me, laughing, and said to his wife, "Sally, you have done it again. This one is here to stay." After we washed our hands, my cousin Ali, 21 years old, was called to the veranda and asked to show me where I was to sleep. I took my plastic bag and followed him to another house that was behind the one with my uncle's bedroom. The passageway between the houses was like a pathway with stones carefully placed on each side of the walkway. Ali held the door for me as I entered the clean, organized room. The bed was made, the clothes that hung on a post were ironed, the shoes were properly lined on a rack, and the brown tile floor was shiny. He pulled a mattress from under the bed and explained to me that I would sleep on the floor, as he and his roommate shared the bed. I was to fold the mattress and put it back under the bed every morning. After he was done explaining how I could contribute to keeping the room clean and in order, I went back to the veranda and sat with my uncle. He put his arm around me and pulled on my nose. "Are you familiar with the city?" Uncle asked. "Not really. Ali will take you around sometime if you like. Or you can venture out there yourself. Get lost and find your way. It will be a good way to get to know the city," he chuckled. We heard a call for prayer that echoed throughout the city. "I have to go for prayers. If you need anything, ask your cousins," he said, taking a kettle from the stoop and beginning to perform ablution. After he was done, he walked down the hill to a nearby mosque. My aunt came out of the room, tying her head with a cloth, and followed my uncle. I sighed, sitting alone on the veranda. I was no longer nervous, but I missed Benin home. Later that night, when my uncle and aunt returned from prayers, all my new family gathered around a cassette player on the veranda to listen to stories. My uncle rubbed his hands, pressed the play button, and a famous storyteller named Lele Gbomba began telling a story about a man who had forgotten his heart at home when he went traveling around the world. I had heard the story in my grandmother's village when I was younger. My new family laughed throughout the telling of the story. I only smiled and was very quiet that night, as I was to be for a while more. But gradually, I adjusted to being around people who were happy all the time. A day or two after I had started living with my uncle, Ali gave me my first pair of dress shoes, a dress belt, and a stylish shirt. "If you want to be a gentleman, you have to dress like one," he laughed. I was about to ask him why he had given me these things when he began to explain. "This is a secret. I want to take you to a dance tonight so you can enjoy yourself. We will leave after Uncle goes to bed." That night, we snuck out and went dancing at a pub. As Ali and I walked, I remembered when I used to go dancing back in secondary school with friends. It seemed so long ago, but I still recall the different names of the dance nights: Back to School, Pants Down, Bob Marley Night, and many more. We would dance until cockcrow, then take off our sweaty shirts, enjoying the cool morning breeze as we walked back to our dorms. I was truly happy back then. "We are here," Ali said, shaking my hand and snapping his fingers. There were lots of young people waiting in line to get into the pub. The boys were well dressed, their pants ironed and shirts tucked in. The girls wore beautiful flower dresses and high heels that made them taller than some of the boys they were with. Their lips were also painted with bright colors. Ali was excited, and he chatted with the people in front of us. I was quiet, looking at the different colored lights that hung at the entrance. There was one big blue light that made people's white shirts especially beautiful. We finally made it to the entrance, and Ali paid for the two of us. The music was extremely loud inside, but then again, I had not been to a pub for many years. I followed Ali to the bar area, where we found a table, and sat on two high stools. "I am going to the dance floor," Ali announced, screaming so that I could hear him. He disappeared into the crowd. I sat for a while, scoping out the place, and slowly began dancing by myself in the corner of the dance floor. Suddenly, an extremely dark girl, whose smile illuminated the dance floor, pulled me and led me to the middle of the floor before I could resist. She started dancing close to me. I looked back at Ali, who was standing at the bar. He gave me a thumbs up, and I began to move slowly until the rhythm took over. I danced one ragamuffin song with the girl, and then there was a slow jam. She pulled me toward her, and I held her hand delicately as we swayed to the music. I could feel her heartbeat. She tried to catch my eyes, but I looked away. In the middle of the song, some older boy pulled her away from me. She waved as she was being escorted through the crowd and toward the door. "You are smooth, man. I saw that." Ali was now standing next to me. He began walking toward the bar, and I followed him. We leaned against the counter facing the dance floor. He was still smiling. "I really didn't do anything. She just wanted to dance with me and I couldn't say no," I said. "Exactly. You say nothing and the women come to you," he teased. I didn't want to talk anymore. A memory of a time we had attacked during a school dance had been triggered. I could hear the terrified cries of teachers and students. Could see the blood cover the dance floor. Ali tapped me on the shoulder and brought me back to the present. I smiled at him, but I was deeply sad for the rest of our stay. We danced all night and returned before Uncle woke up. A few nights later, I returned to the pub alone and saw the same girl. She told me her name was Zainab. "Sorry about last time," she said. "My brother wanted to go home and I had to go with him, otherwise my parents would have gotten worried." Like me, she was alone this night. I dated her for 3 weeks, but then she began to ask too many questions. Where was I from? What was it like growing up upline? Upline is a Creole word mostly used in Freetown to refer to the backwardness of the inner country, its inhabitants, and their mannerisms. I was unwilling to tell her anything, so she broke it off. That was the story of my relationship with girls in Freetown. They wanted to know about me, and I wasn't ready to tell them. It was okay. I liked being alone. Leslie came to see me. He asked how I was doing, what I had been up to. I wanted to tell him that I had had one severe migraine wherein the image of a burning village flashed in my mind, followed by wailings of many voices, that I had felt the back of my neck tighten and my head become heavy, as if a huge rock had been placed on it. Instead, I told him only that everything was fine. Leslie put out a pad and began writing something on it. When he was done, he turned to me and said, "I have a proposition for you. It is important." "Always the bearer of news, aren't you?" I joked. "This is important." He studied the pad he held in his hand and continued. "There is an interview for two children to be sent to the United Nations in New York, in America, to talk about the lives of children in Sierra Leone and what can be done about it. Mr. Kamara, the director of your former rehabilitation center, recommended that you go for the interview. Here is the address, if you're interested." He tore the paper off and handed it to me. As I was looking at it, he went on, "If you want me to go with you, come by the office. Dress up for the interview, okay?" He searched my face for an answer. I didn't say anything. Afterward, he left with a smile on his face that said he knew I would show up for the interview. The day of the interview finally arrived, and I dressed casually for it. I wore sneakers, nice black pants, and a green long-sleeve shirt. I tucked my shirt in as I walked to Shaka Stevens Street, to the address that Leslie had given me. I told no one where I was going. I had wanted to talk to Ali about it, but hesitated because I knew that if I did, I would have to tell him more than he knew about me, more than my uncle had told him. It was almost midday, but the tar road was already too hot. I watched a flying plastic bag land on the road and immediately begin to melt. Podapodas went by, their apprentices shouting the names of their destinations to attract customers. A few feet ahead, a vehicle had stopped on the side of the street, and the driver was pouring water from a jerry can into its overheated engine. "This car drinks more water than a cow," he grumbled. I was walking slowly, but my undershirt got soaked with sweat. When I arrived at the address, I stood in front of the tall building and marveled at its height before entering. In the lobby, there were about 20 boys all dressed better than I. Their parents were giving them last-minute points for the interview. I studied the big cement columns in the building. I liked thinking about how people had managed to create and erect such large cement pillars. I was busy examining one pillar when a man tapped me on the shoulder and asked if I was there for the interview. I nodded, and he pointed to the open metal box that all the boys now stood in. I hesitantly walked into the congested box, and the boys laughed at me as I stood there unaware that I had to press the button for the box to start moving. I had never been in a box like this before. Where was it taking us? A boy in a blue shirt squeezed his way past me and pressed the number 5 button. It lit up, and the box closed on us. I looked about me and saw that everyone was calm, so I knew that there was no need to worry. The box began to move up fast. The other boys remained calm, adjusting their ties and shirts. When the doors opened, I was the last to step out into a large open room with brown leather couches. There was a man sitting at the desk at the far wall, and he motioned for me to find a place to sit. The other boys had already seated themselves. I sat away from them and looked about the room. Through the window, I could see the tops of the other buildings, and I decided to get up and look around to see how high up from the ground we were. As I was making my way to the window, my name was called. A really light-skinned man, I couldn't tell if he was Sierra Leonean or not, sat in a big black leather chair. "Please have a seat, and I'll be with you in a moment," he said in English. And he shuffled through some papers, picked up a phone, and dialed a number. When the person picked up on the other end, the man just said, "It is a go-ahead," and hung up. He turned toward me and eyed me for a bit before he began to question me, speaking very slowly in English. "What is your name?" he asked, looking at the list of names on his desk. "Ishmael," I said, and he checked my name before I could tell him my last name. "Why do you think you should go to the UN to present the situation affecting children in this country?" He raised his head from the list and looked at me. "Well, I am from the part of the country where I have not only suffered because of the war, but I have also participated in it and undergone rehabilitation. So I have a better understanding, based on my experience, of the situation than any of these city boys who are here for the interview. What are they going to say when they go over there? They don't know anything about the war except the news of it." I looked at the man, who was smiling, and it made me a bit angry. "What else do you have to say?" he asked. "Nothing, except that I am wondering why you are smiling." I sat back in the soft leather chair. "You can go now," the man said, still smiling. I got up and left the room, leaving the door open behind me. I walked toward the box and stood by it. I stood there and waited for several minutes, but nothing happened. I didn't know what to do to make the box come upstairs. The boys who were waiting for the interview began to laugh. The man who sat behind the desk walked toward me and pushed a button on the wall. The doors immediately opened, and I walked in. The man pressed the number 1 button and waved to me as the doors closed. I tried to find something to hold onto, but the box was already at street level. I walked out of the building and stood outside, examining its structure. "I have to tell Muhammad about the inside of this marvelous building when I see him," I thought. I walked home slowly that afternoon, watching the cars go by. I didn't think much about the interview except that I still wondered why the man who had interviewed me had smiled. I meant what I said, and it was not a funny matter. At some point, during my walk, a convoy of cars, military vans, and Mercedes-Benzes festooned with national flags passed by. Their windows were tinted, so I couldn't see who rode in them, and they were too fast anyway. When I got home, I asked Ali if he knew of a powerful man who parades the city in such a way. He told me that it was Tijankaba, the new president, who had won the election under the banner of the Sierra Leone People's Party, SLPP, in March 1996, 8 months earlier. I had never heard of this man. That night, my uncle brought home a bag of groundnut. Auntie Sally boiled the groundnut and put it out on a large tray. All of us, my uncle, his wife, Ali, Kona, Matilda, Sumbo, and I, sat around the tray and ate the groundnut, listening to another recording of Lele Gbomba's. He was telling a story about how he became friends with another boy before they were born. Their mothers were neighbors and were pregnant at the same time, so the two of them met while they were still in their mothers' bellies. The storyteller vividly described the landscape of their pre-infant life, the hunting they did, the games they played, how they listened to our world. It was a very funny story that took shockingly impossible twists and turns and left us in awe. My uncle, aunt and cousins laughed so hard that they couldn't stop for hours, even after the story had ended. I began to laugh too, because my uncle was trying to say something and he was so possessed with laughter that he couldn't say a complete word without launching into another fit of laughter. "We should do this again. Laughing like this is good for the soul," my uncle said, still laughing a little. We wished one another a good night and went to our different sleeping places. One morning, Mr. Kamara turned up at my uncle's house in the Children Associated with the War, CAW, van. He had told me I had been chosen to go to the UN a few days before, but I had only told Mohammed about this, as I didn't actually believe that I was going to travel to New York City. It was before midday when Mr. Kamara arrived and my uncle had left for work. My aunt was in the kitchen. The look on her face told me that my uncle would learn about Mr. Kamara's visit. I knew then that I would have to tell my uncle about the trip. "Good morning," Mr. Kamara said, checking his watch to make sure it was still morning. "Good morning," I replied. "Are you ready to go to town and begin preparation for the trip?" he asked in English. Since Mr. Kamara had found out that I had been chosen to go to the UN, he had spoken only English to me. I said goodbye to my aunt and jumped in the van, and we took off to get me a passport. It seemed as if everyone in the city had decided to get passports that day, perhaps preparing to leave the country. Luckily, Mr. Kamara had made an appointment, so we didn't have to wait in line. At the counter, he presented my photo, the necessary forms, and the fee. A round-faced man carefully examined the documents and asked for my birth certificate. "You have to show me proof that you were born in this country," the man said. I became really upset and almost slapped the man, who insisted that I must present proof of birth in Sierra Leone, even after I told him that no one had a chance to assemble documents of that nature when the war reached them. He was naive about the reality I was trying to explain to him. Mr. Kamara pulled me aside and gently asked me to sit on a bench while he chatted with the man. Eventually, he demanded to see his boss. After hours of waiting, someone was able to dig up a copy of my birth certificate, and they told Mr. Kamara to come back for the passport in 4 days. "The first step is completed. Now we will have to get you the visa," Mr. Kamara said as we walked out of the passport office. I didn't reply because I was still upset, exhausted, and just wanted to go home. My uncle was home when I was dropped off that evening. When I greeted him, he had a smile on his face that said, "Tell me what is going on." I did. I told him that I was going to the United Nations in New York City and talk about the war, as it relates to children. My uncle didn't believe it. "People are always lying to others with such promises. Don't let them get your hopes up, my son," he said. Every morning before he left for work, he would say jokingly, "So what are we doing today in planning to go to America?" Mr. Kamara took me shopping. He bought me a suitcase and some clothes, mostly long-sleeve shirts, dress pants, and traditionally waxed, colorful cotton suits with intricate embroidery on the collars, sleeves, and hems of pants. I showed these things to my uncle, but still he didn't believe that I would be going on the trip. "Maybe they just want to give you a new look, a more African look, instead of those big pants you always wear," he joked. Sometimes, my uncle and I went for strolls after work. He would ask how I was doing. I always told him I was fine. He would put his long arms around me and pull me closer. I felt he knew that I wanted to tell him certain things but couldn't find the right words. I hadn't told him that whenever I went to the bush with my cousins to fetch firewood, my mind would begin to wander to the things I had seen and done in the past. Standing next to a tree with the red frozen sap on its bark would bring flashbacks of the many times we executed prisoners by tying them to trees and shooting them. Their blood stained the trees and never washed off, even during the rainy season. I hadn't told him that often. I was reminded of what I had missed by watching the daily activities of families, a child hugging his father, or holding two parents' hands, swinging over gutters. It made me wish I could go back to the beginning and change things. I had been told to meet a man by the name of Dr. Tamba at the American Embassy on Monday morning. As I walked to the embassy, I listened to the gradual awakening of the city. The call for prayer from the central mosque echoed throughout the city. Podapodas crowded the streets, their apprentices hanging on the open passenger doors and calling out the names of their destinations. Lomli Lomli or Congo Town. It was still too early when I arrived, but there was already a long line of people waiting outside the embassy gates. Their faces were sad and filled with uncertainty, as if they awaited some trial that would determine whether they would die or stay alive. I didn't know what to do, so I stood in line. After an hour or so, Dr. Tamba arrived with another boy and asked me to follow him. He looked like a dignified man, so I guess we didn't have to wait in line. The other boy, who was also a former child soldier, introduced himself. "My name is Ba. I am happy to be going on this journey with you," he said, shaking my hand. I thought about what my uncle's reply would be to him. "Don't let them get your hopes up, young man." We sat down on one of the few decent benches in a small open area in the embassy and waited for our interview. A white woman stood behind a transparent glass window. Her voice came through the speakers underneath it. "What is the purpose of your visit to the United States?" she asked, never looking up from the papers before her. When it was our turn, the woman behind the glass already had our passports. She didn't look at me, rather she flipped through the pages of my new passport. I was very confused about why the window was set up in such a way that the human connection was lost between the interviewer and the interviewee. "Speaking to the microphone," she said, and she continued, "What is the purpose of your visit to the United States?" "For a conference," I said. "What is the conference about?" "It is generally about issues affecting children around the world," I explained. "And where is this conference?" "At the UN in New York City." "Do you have any guarantee that you will come back to your home country?" I was thinking when she continued, "Do you have any property or bank account that will guarantee your return?" I frowned. "Do you know anything about people's lives in this country?" I thought of asking her. If she could only look at me directly, perhaps she wouldn't have asked the last two questions. No one my age in my country has a bank account or even dreams of having one, much less property to declare. Mr. Tamba told her that he was the CAW chaperone going on the trip with us and that he would make sure that we returned to Sierra Leone at the end of the conference. The woman asked me the final question. "Do you know anyone in the United States?" "No, I have never been anywhere out of this country, and this is actually my first time in this city," I told her. She closed my passport and put it aside. "Come back at 4:30. Outside, Dr. Tamba told us that we had gotten the visas and that he would pick up the passports and hold on to them until the day of our departure. It had finally begun to look as if we were going to travel, even though I had seen my passport only at a glance. I held my suitcase in my right hand and was wearing traditional summer pants with zigzag thread patterns at the bottom and a t-shirt. My uncle was sitting on the veranda when I came from Ali's room. "I am on my way to the airport," I said, smiling as I knew my uncle was going to be sarcastic. "Sure, give me a call when you get to America." "Well, I don't have a phone, so call Aminata's house and she can come and get me," my uncle giggled. "Okay, I will," I said, giggling as well. "Ah, children, come and say goodbye to your brother. I do not know where he is going, but he needs our blessings," my uncle said. Matilda, Kona, and Sombo came to the veranda holding buckets in their hands. They were on their way to fetch water. They hugged me and wished me luck on my journey. My aunt came out of the kitchen smelling of smoke, and hugged me. "Wherever you are going, you will need to smell like your home. This is my perfume to you," she giggled, and stepped back. My uncle stood up and hugged me, put his arm around my shoulder, and said, "My good wishes are with you, so I will see you later for dinner then." He went back to sit in his chair on the veranda. Chapter 20. My conception of New York City came from rap music. I envisioned it as a place where people shot each other on the street and got away with it. No one walked on the streets. Rather, people drove in their sports cars looking for nightclubs and for violence. I really wasn't looking forward to being somewhere this crazy. I had had enough of that back home. It was dark when the plane landed at John F. Kennedy International Airport. It was 4:30 p.m. I asked Dr. Tamba why it was dark so early in this country. "Because it is winter," he said. "Oh," I nodded, but the early darkness still didn't make sense to me. I knew the word winter from Shakespeare's texts, and I thought I should look up its meaning again. Dr. Tamba took our passports and did all the talking at immigration. We got our bags and headed toward the sliding doors. Maybe we shouldn't just venture into the streets like that, I thought, but Dr. Tamba was already outside. When Ba and I stepped through the sliding doors, we were greeted by an extremely cold wind. I felt my skin tighten. I couldn't feel my face, and it seemed my ears had fallen off, my fingers hurt, and my teeth chattered. The wind penetrated through the summer pants and the t-shirt I was wearing, and it felt as though I wasn't wearing anything. I was shivering as I ran back into the terminal. I had never in my life felt this cold. How can anyone survive in this country? I thought, rubbing my hands together and jumping around to generate some heat. Ba stood outside with Dr. Tamba, his hands wrapped around himself and shaking uncontrollably. For some reason, Dr. Tamba had a jacket, but Ba and I didn't. I waited in the terminal while Dr. Tamba hailed a taxi. Then I ran outside and jumped in, quickly closing the door behind me. There were little white things falling out of the sky, and they seemed to be accumulating on the ground. "What is this white stuff falling from the sky?" I thought to myself. Dr. Tamba told the driver our destination, reading it off a piece of paper he held in his hand. "Is this your first time in the city, and are you guys enjoying the beautiful snowfall?" the taxi driver asked. "Yes, it is their first time in the city," Dr. Tamba replied and busied himself putting away our documents. I had never heard of the word snow before. It is not exactly something that we discuss in Sierra Leone, but I had seen movies about Christmas, and this white fluffy stuff was in those movies. It must be Christmas here every day, I thought. When we entered the city, it seemed as if someone had lit the many tall buildings that shot into the sky. From afar, some of the buildings looked as if they were made of colorful lights. The city glittered, and I was so completely overwhelmed that I couldn't decide where to look. I thought I had seen tall buildings in Freetown, but these were beyond tall. It seemed they were poking the sky. There were so many cars on the street, and they impatiently honked even when the light was red. And then I saw people walking on the sidewalks. I rubbed my eyes to make sure that I was really seeing people on the streets of New York City. It wasn't as dangerous as I had heard it was. Not so far. The lights were brighter than the ones back home, and I kept looking for the utility poles that the electric wires hung on, but I couldn't see any. We arrived at the Vanderbilt YMCA Hotel on 47th Street and entered the lobby holding our luggage. We followed Dr. Tamba to the front desk and got our room keys. I had a room to myself for the first time in my life. To top that, I had a television which I watched all night long. It was really hot in the room, so I took my clothes off and sweated in front of the television. 2 days later, I learned that the reason the room was so hot was that the radiator was on full blast. I didn't know what it looked like, least of all how to turn the heat down or off. I remembered thinking about the strangeness of this country. It is very cold outside and extremely hot inside. On the morning following our arrival, I went downstairs to the cafeteria, where 57 children from 23 countries were waiting to have breakfast and to begin the United Nations' first International Children's Parliament. There were children from Lebanon, Cambodia, Kosovo, Brazil, Norway, Yemen, Mozambique, Palestine, Guatemala, the US, New York, South Africa, Peru, Northern Ireland, India, Papua New Guinea, Malawi, to name a few. While I was looking around for Bar and Dr. Tamba, a white woman pulled me to the side and introduced herself. "My name is Kristin. I am from Norway." She extended her hand. "I am Ishmael from Sierra Leone." I shook her hand, and she opened an envelope of name tags and placed one on my shirt. She smiled and motioned for me to join the breakfast line as she walked away, looking for other children without name tags. I followed behind two boys who were speaking a strange language. They knew what they wanted, but I had no idea what to get or what the names of the foods were that the cooks were making. Throughout my stay, I was baffled by the food. I would simply order the same thing, or put on my plate whatever I had seen others put on theirs. Sometimes I was lucky to like what landed there. That was usually not the case. I asked Dr. Tamba if he knew where we could get some rice and fish stew in palm oil, some cassava leaves or okra soup. He smiled and said, "When you are in Rome, you do as the Romans do." I should have brought my own food from home to hold me until I learn about the food in this country, I thought, as I drank my glass of orange juice. After breakfast, we walked 2 blocks in the freezing weather down to a building where most of the meetings took place. It was still snowing outside, and I was wearing summer dress pants and a long-sleeve shirt.